Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. I'm excited to welcome you back for another weekly market recap with my good friend, portfolio manager Lance Roberts. I'm excited because, folks, the move is over. I'm in the new place. We got the new studio. It looks like the old studio. Everything's great. So much happier to be on this side of the move. Lance, how are you doing this week, buddy?
I'm fine. I think the move didn't happen. You're at your old place, and this is all just a setup.
This is all just a lie. It was all just a play for sympathy.
You become the government.
No, fortunately or unfortunately, we made the move. It was a good thing. It was a pain in the neck as moves go. Funny story I might tell later. But you probably can't see it now, but I you could tell I moved because I had this cut on the bridge of my nose earlier this week when I was recording because managed to drop one of the boxes on my face during the move period. You're laughing as I'm saying this. My wife then did the same thing late last night in the dark. Same thing, box on her nose. She looks like she's got an abusive husband. I'm sure she's getting all sorts of stares and sympathy right now. People whispering, look, just blink if you're in an abusive relationship, lady. Beyond those cuts and bruises, it went well.
No, that's good. Yeah.
All right.
Well, you made it. Booze are never fun.
Well, thanks. Yeah. They're not. But again, like I said, I don't deserve any sympathy. And I'm much happier to be on this side of it. All right. But Lance, look, we got a lot to talk about. I'm going to lean on you a little bit more than normal this week because I've been a bit heads down with the move and catching up and all that stuff. I think I've caught everything that happened. But if I miss something big, put it on the table here. First question I have for you, though, is, the market appeared to be in rally mode coming into April from a strong March. It was in rally mode 4 out of 5 days this week, but it has given up a lot of the rally on Friday. And when I compare where the market is today, the S&P where it is today, it's actually pretty close to where it started the month. So my question for you is are we in party on mode still? Or are we in party ending mode?
Actually, party on mode. If you go back in my newsletter 3-4 weeks ago now, I had to go back and actually look. And I actually tweeted this out this morning just a bit. By the way, let me say something about Twitter real fast because sure. I'll answer your question. I made a comment on Twitter that I would never pay for verification because I'm just opposed to paying anybody for anything. But my company opted to go ahead and pay for the verification because we had two people taken in to scams off of stuff that came off of bot accounts that are representing me. They're using my face. They're using my name to some degree. And promoting, soliciting, trading issues, cryptocurrency and stuff like that. I just want to say, we said this before, but we went ahead and got my account verified so that if something comes for me, it's not for me because I don't solicit or DM anybody for anything. I'll respond maybe to your comment, but that's it. But if it's not a verified account, it's not me. So don't take anything that comes off of Twitter under my name or my face as something being solicited, because I would never solicit you for anything.
Okay. On that, I'll say, look, if you're on Twitter following Lance, look for the blue check, right? But in general, what you're saying, and I'm going to say the same thing again about me and Wealthion as well, because I have the same issue with all these imposters that are out there. Blue check or not, never going to reach out and solicit anybody individually through social media for anything, but certainly for something that would cost you money, right? So just be aware, there's a lot of scammers. If you're watching this probably on YouTube, in the YouTube comments, I go through them multiple times a day to try to delete all the scam imposters there that are trying to get people to buy some sort of crypto thing or to have you contact them on WhatsApp or whatnot. And they start a discussion. It's amazing how much work these people put in to actually create a dialogue and pretend that they're us. But it invariably rolls around to some sort of pitch that's going to ask you for money. Those are all scammers, folks. We'll never do that. I and Wealthion never will. Lance RA never will.
Absolutely. So anyway, having said that, okay, so back to our story. So 3-4 weeks ago, I had mentioned that the market had had a very big run and it was very overbought and that we needed to see a bit of rotation. Technology had been leading the way. And we're likely going to see a bit of rotation into some other areas of the markets, healthcare, real estate, et cetera. that's actually been going on for the last week or so. Markets haven't really gone anywhere. We were down on Wednesday over 1%. We were up on Thursday over 1%. I mean, it's just been back and forth all week, down again on Friday here because of weak retail sales. But this is just part of that consolidation. If you know, one thing we've talked about in past weekend's newsletter, as well as our daily market commentary, which, by the way, if you want to subscribe to something, it's all free, and I'm not going to solicit you to subscribe to it, but we put this stuff out for you every day, you know, at the website. So nobody's
not going to solicit individually, but in general to everybody.
I'm going to solicit. Get our free stuff. It'll help you manage your money better. But the thing is, we've been noting this breakout of the market from this downtrend. So we've had a very nice defined downtrend since April of last year. We broke above that, retested that breakout level, and we're holding that breakout level. And that's very important. And that's a very bullish kind of setup here for the markets. Markets are not overbought yet. MACD buy signals are still in place. So the upward trend of the market remains intact. On Tuesday, I published an article on the website talking about bullishness is returning, and that's actually kind of bullish in itself because we don't have excess bullishness. People are not bullish. In fact, people are more bearish than they are bullish. And historically, that kind of that gentle turn where you start to see people come a little less bearish has typically been near market lows. And we're seeing that kind of action here. So you're starting to finally convince investors that maybe the worst is behind us, and they're starting to kind of look out to, well, inflation's coming down, the economy's not falling off a cliff entirely. We kind of have this rolling recession through the economy. You know, we've had some manufacturing slow down, we had the housing slow down, now we've got this commercial real estate. So we've had like this rolling recession in the economy rather than everything just kind of falling out of the bottom at one time. It's been kind of moving through the market and moving through the economy. So the markets seem to be picking up on this. It doesn't mean that there's not more downside risk, but I think you have to give some deference to what's happening with price action in the market, which is clearly more bullish than bearish.
All right. I want to give you props again, Lance, because there is still a lot of data out there that is not encouraging. Yep. We're going to talk about some of that in a little bit here. But you have long been warning about either markets being oversold or the fact that, you know, you're seeing indicators that suggest that the market could rally here. And you were saying this, you know, a few months back, you know, back when the S&P was down at 3,900, 38 something, right? And back then, I remember a lot of the comments, people being like, Lance is just smoking something here. He's not paying attention to the data. And the markets have, you know, they've surprised to the upside, I would say, for many people here. And you're basically saying you wouldn't be surprised if things continued to go higher from here. So we're at about 4130 or so on the S&P right now. I know I'm asking you to sort of guesstimate a bit here, but how much do you think could be left in the tank? You know, like what do you see us going up to here potentially?
So I wrote an article. I want to say I have to go back and look at the actual date. Maybe it was January that I wrote an article that kind of pegged this rally to around 4,200. So we're getting pretty close. Oh, I'm sorry. I think it was early January. I'll find the date for you. But I wrote an article said, you know, kind of a target for this rally is around 4,200, and we're close to that. And you know, could the market go higher from there? Yeah, there's potential upside to 43, 4,400, but you're going to need a bit more of a catalyst, I think, to push it there. One, and now catalyst could be earnings. We just started earnings season really today. We've had some earnings this week, but today was really the big kickoff. The banks kind of denote the big kickoff of the bank. JP Morgan out today, crushed earnings on net interest income, of course, because they pay you squat on your money market and they borrow from the Fed at 4.5%. So not surprisingly, their net income jumped by 49% year over year. So if I could do that game, I'm in that business too. So, but if earnings, you know, earnings have come down. I've actually got a chart in this weekend's newsletter that I'll be posting on Saturday that shows earnings estimates. In May of just this past year, earnings estimates for the S&P were around $230 a share. they're now down to $172 a share. So you've had a very, and this is only for Q1 estimates, right? So the estimate for quarter one earnings for 2023 was around 230 in May of last year, now down to 172. So this is what I call millennial earnings season, right? We lower the bar, companies beat the bar, everybody gets a trophy, and that gives market support. Now, it doesn't mean that earnings didn't decline markedly, because they did, but we're still beating these much lowered estimates. So everybody gets a trophy, and it's all good. But that could get, now, again, and it's not really the beats we need to pay attention to. We need to pay attention to what the companies say about the next 6, 8, 12 months. Are they becoming more optimistic about the outlook for the economy? Or are they more concerned about sales and revenue? You know, if you take a look at the CEO confidence index, which is published quarterly, it's at some of the lowest levels on record. So CEOs as of last quarter were not optimistic. Has that level of confidence improved this quarter? We'll find out. But that's what you're looking for. If you start seeing this kind of turn in optimism from companies talking about expectations of recovering the economy, that type of thing, that's going to give some more fuel to this market. Because again, what's going to happen is that if that occurs, estimates are going to rise and markets will track estimates. And we've talked about that before. What the market prices in is what they think earnings are going to do. I'm going to buy today what I think earnings will be tomorrow on cash flow. So watch for what they say. And if those outlooks become more optimistic, that could give some support to the markets. If not, and the outlook is more pessimistic, then economic data continues to deteriorate. Retail sales, obviously not a good sign today. Then we're probably going to have another 10% down leg at this in this market at some point, probably this summer.
Okay. In terms of what we're hearing so far in these early stages of earnings season, do we have a bead yet on what companies are saying? Did the banks say something one way or the other, or is it too early?
Well, it's too early. JP Morgan said, hey, we crushed it because we don't pay our savers anything. So please make your deposits here. You know, but they, you know, their thing was, you know, we're not seeing any banking stress, of course, right? We don't see any banking stress. We're fine. We have a massive trading desk. We don't pay you any money on your deposits. So we're doing great. Now, we don't know about the other guys, but we're awesome.
Yeah. So that being said, sorry to interrupt, but right. JP Morgan was, you know, they were special in the sense that Jamie Dimon came out pretty early, you know, I would say almost a year ago now. He was using the term economic hurricane and whatnot. Yeah. And I do remember reading, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, he was beginning to sort of moderate that a bit. Okay, maybe it's not going to be a hurricane. Has he given any recent additional color on that as far as you know?
No, he hasn't. Well, he hasn't said anything further about that. He still said recently that, you know, still expects some economic weakness. His outlook, though, was for a stronger outlook for profits and growth for the bank this year. So if he's expecting that, he's obviously not expecting an economic hurricane, right?
Well, maybe, and that's probably true. But, you know, if anything that weakens the banking system generally is going to strengthen JP Morgan, right? Because all the deposits and all the business the many weaker banks have are going to go to him, right?
That's a fair statement. So yeah, it's like, yeah, I hope the economy crashes because I'll be rich. Yeah,
exactly. It's pretty good to be too big to fail, right? Yeah,
exactly. I think there's a real important takeaway from all this is that, you know, what we've done since 2008, we won't get into this whole debate because we've done this before, is that, you know, we have completely screwed our financial system up by creating these kind of these monsters of banking, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, which are, as I've said before, they're basically the mafia. They're criminal enterprises. They take, you know, again, net interest income is a good example, right? Go put your money in a money market account at a brokerage firm, get 4.5, or put it at JP Morgan and get 0. I mean, something's not right. Mm-hmm. And these guys come out and talk about equality and diversity and equity and all this nonsense. And then basically they pay their savers nothing. So, hey.
Well, they're consistent. They're ripping off depositors of all creeds, races and colors. Right?
We're seeing that there. You talk about needing to have all this social equality, but yet you're not doing anything to help savers. I mean, Jesus Christ, at 4.5%, pay your savers 2%. You're right. Still making 2.5% on your deposits, right? It's just ridiculous. Anyway, see, you get me all fired up about this. Now let's move on.
All right. Okay. But so when we meet next week, will we have enough data to start to have enough of an early bead on, yeah, on kind of what industry is saying about whether it's getting more or less optimistic?
We will. By May the 5th, we will have 88% of the S&P 500 reported. So by the time we get to the 5th of May, you and I are going to have a lot. I've already started writing an analysis, and I'm just waiting for the data to feed in now. I've already created the entire report. But I'll have a full report on this quarter's earnings seasons versus expectations from a year ago, just how bad the analysts were and what this actually looks like from here. So over the next couple of weeks, you and I are going to have a lot to talk about.
Okay. Well, we will. And I haven't looked at the latest Fed funds futures, but we've talked about this a lot in the past couple of videos where we're having a great disconnect right now between what the Fed is saying it's going to do with the Fed funds rate and what the market thinks the Fed's going to do. And we've talked about how somebody's going to have to be wrong in that equation. And let's just assume for a second that the CEOs are more sanguine during this earnings season. That's only going to sort of exacerbate, I think, that disconnect, right?
Fed fund futures by Wall Street, you know, they're expecting the Fed to start cutting rates as early as July.
Right.
You know, the odds of a rate hike in May are now almost certain for a 25 basis point rate hike.
It's. I'll put it up here. I had this for later on, but the CME Fed Watch tool pegs a 25 basis point hike at 80% right now.
Yeah. So you know, there's a huge, you know, if the Fed's going to hike 25 basis point May, you know, why would they cut in July? And look, I go back to this basic question that I asked you before, and it was obviously a rhetorical question then. It's still a rhetorical question now, but this is the one thing I don't gather. I was doing Fox Business today, and I was on a panel with another guy, and he said that, well, you know, the Fed's going to start cutting rates, and I'm sitting in my mind, well, why would the Fed cut rates if the market's doing fine, right? We're in a bull market ish, right? Markets are going up, so it's technically a bull market. Prices are rising. The economy's not falling off a cliff right now. I mean, yes, GDP now has come down from where it started out. It started out near 2.5% or wherever it was. It's now down to below 2%, but it's not negative for the first quarter. So if the economy's not in recession, if the market's doing fine, and then why?
Unemployment's still low.
Unemployment's still low. Yes, jobless claims have started to rise. Continuing claims have started to rise. So that certainly shows some weakness there, but nothing dramatic. Then why would the Fed cut rates, right? I mean, the Fed is going to use that tool. And here's the thing I come back to. If I'm Jerome Powell and I've got interest rates at 5% and I'm reducing my balance sheet and everything is going okay, I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to keep rates at 5 and keep reducing my balance sheet as long as everything goes okay, because I want to save that tool. I mean, look at all the ammo I've now got. For the first time in like 20 years, there's a decent spread between the Fed funds rate and zero. So I've got a good way I can lower rates to help support an economic recession at some point. So this idea by Wall Street, they're just going to randomly start cutting rates without some other event in place is a bit baffling to me. Maybe I'm entirely wrong. Maybe I'm missing something I don't see, but I can't see the Fed cutting rates without there being a recession, a financial crisis, or a banking issue.
Right. Which, as we've said many times when we talk about this, is not bullish for stocks.
Correct.
All right. Let's get into some of the data of the week. And you already gave a nod to some of it here. So we got at least two bits of important information this week. We got the latest CPI numbers for March. We also got the retail sales numbers for March. And they're actually, they sing from the same song sheet, right? So CPI's come down, right? Headline CPI came down from 6% in February to 5.0% in March, right? So you and I have been talking about disinflation for a good long while now, right? Yep. I think we missed the peak by a month in calling the peak, but we've been pretty good, mm-hmm, I think, in calling the direction. And, you know, one of the big questions out there right now is, okay, well, you know, how long is it going to take to tame inflation? And jury is still totally out on that right now. Things like the OPEC production cut, you know, are not going to help. That's going to be somewhat inflationary. But there's a whole host of other things that could continue to really pull the CPI down, and we're gonna watch. So, you know, folks, don't worry, stay tuned. What I find really interesting about where we are right now is, you know, yes, 5% is coming down from where we were at 9% back, you know, last fall. But it's still uncomfortably high for the Fed, right? You know, Powell has very recently publicly stated, I'm going to 2. I'm not going to stop until it's at 2, right? What's interesting is it's now at the same rate as T-bills.
Yes.
So T-bills are yielding basically 5%, right? 4.8, I think the 3-month was trading at the other day, right? So Lance, when is the last time we've actually had a 0% or maybe heading towards positive real return on T-bills?
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Actually, I can't remember when.
Yeah, I can't either. So how notable is that?
Well, you know, again, this goes back to, you know, a lot of things that we've talked about in the past is that, you know, there's been these economic deformations for so long now. You know, you go back to the financial crisis and, you know, we lowered rates to 0. We basically forced investors out of, you know, savings into equity markets to take on risk just to get some type of yield. So, you know, it's got a potential consequence. In fact, I'm writing another article called right now. I don't know. People make jokes because they're going to bring stuff up. It's like, yeah, I'm writing an article on this, but I'm actually writing an article called "Taking Risk Is No Longer Necessary," because, you know, this has real consequences for the markets going forward. Because
exactly, because there is an alternative.
There is an alternative, and if the markets are dependent on, you know, money flowing into the equity markets to boost asset prices, and now money doesn't have to, your buyers, your set of buyers that were there for the last decade now potentially go away. And so that's going to certainly, and again, you know, what's important about this is, and I've said this before, is that between 1900 and 2008, the market returned on average about 8%, right? You hear that number all the time, right? And that's what you would expect. That's basically the growth of the economy at 6% plus 2% dividends. That's how you get to 8%. Between 2008 and 2020, we grew at 12% annually. Because of all the monetary intervention, zero interest rates, and forcing all these savers into the equity markets, we increased the average rate of return by 400 basis points. That is not sustainable because it's above the rate of growth of the economy and what the economy can generate in terms of earnings. And now you set up a situation where people don't have to put money into the markets and your future rates of return look substantially lower. So yeah, it has a very significant consequence.
Yeah, I mean, it's got consequences in both the financial markets and in the economic ones, right? Because financially, you had capital flowing into all these other, you know, asset classes because people were starved for yield, right? Yep. They had to, right? But also, and I'm sort of thinking in real time on this, so, you know, if I'm going off the rails, stop me. But like, you know, money flowing into all those other asset classes is basically helping capital go find, you know, ways to fund things, basically, where if more and more capital now is just going to park in safety and not drive economic activity, does that, to a certain extent, cool the economy a bit, right? Where all of a sudden people aren't investing in housing developments because they have risk, or they're not investing in new companies because they have risk, because, hey, I can get a real return and 5%, you know, on my safe treasuries. So why not?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And that's the inherent consequence of messing around with economic, you know, and capitalistic flows, right? You know, we've created a deformation of capitalism, and which is, you know, now become corporatism. And we talk about all the evils that spun off, right? And wealth inequality and all this. But this is the byproduct. Everybody thought that you could mess with the function of the financial markets. Oh, sure, we can drop rates to 0. We can flood the system with liquidity and there won't be a consequence. here's your consequence, right? And this is going to be the real challenge for the Fed, because every time the Fed has had to do quantitative easing in order to boost asset markets, in order to boost consumer confidence, it's required more and more quantitative easing each time. It's not the same amount of QE to get the same result. It's taking more QE to get the same result out of the markets. That's not sustainable long term. And
that's Lacey's hunt. The Fed is increasingly pushing on an increasingly loose string, right?
Correct. And it does. And the most important thing is that none of that creates economic prosperity on any level. And we now know that from the last 12 years of widening wealth inequality and slower rates of economic growth, all those type of things. So, I mean, we have clear evidence that none of this is beneficial for the economy. It's great if you're invested in the stock market, but that's 10% of the economy, so it doesn't really matter.
Right. But the QE efforts when the Fed does that, but what we're talking about isn't, right? Which is the more attractive these safe investments get, the more money it's going to start sucking out of the stock market, because why take risk, right?
Well, and therein lies the one. So, you know, I said earlier, I can't imagine why the Fed would start cutting rates if everything else is fine. Therein lies the one factor that could belie that whole statement that the Fed's not going to cut rates until there's a crisis. If the Fed needs to get money back into the equity markets, or wants to get money back into the equity markets, whatever form or fashion, then they go, well, the only way to do that is to cut rates back to zero and force people back into chasing assets.
Yeah.
So that's the one outlier to that bit of logical question I threw out earlier. Why would the Fed cut rates? That's the only outlier that is basically, I need to get money back into the financial markets for some reason or the other. I can't think what the reason would be, but that would be it.
Well, that's where I'm going. Okay, there would have to be a reason for that. And I the conversations that I've had this year suggest that, like you, I can't think of a good reason where the Fed would do that intentionally to save the equity markets, right? From what I've heard, who is it? It was John Hathaway, I think, when I was talking with him. He basically said, look, the Fed didn't really care about the stock market. It doesn't care if it really goes up. Doesn't care if it really goes down. It just wants it to be orderly, right? So that's his perspective. You may differ, but the other thing I want to add to him before you respond is Daniel DiMartino Booth and the other folks that are saying, look, this is the Fed's, what the Powell is trying to do right now is kill the Fed put, right? So it seems like there's lots of evidence out there that the Fed is deliberately trying not to save the markets at this point. So unless there's something that is highly disorderly where it's going to be a true rescue, I can't think of a reason why the Fed would just say, I want higher asset prices, because I think they're aware of the Frankenstein monster that they created in the equity markets. And if they can tame that monster without ruining the system, I'm sure they'd love to.
Yeah. Two things about that. One is we have to go back and remember what Ben Bernanke said in 2010, which is that the reason they do QE is to boost asset prices in order to boost consumer confidence, in order to generate economic growth, right?
The wealth effect, yeah.
The wealth effect, exactly right. So I oppose the first opinion, which was, you know, that, you know,
they don't care as long as it's orderly.
They don't care. They do care. And I think they care a lot about where the market is because of its effect on consumer confidence.
And let me just say one thing though. But right now, Powell is trying to create the reverse wealth effect, right? He's trying to destroy demand. He's trying to get people to feel less wealthy, correct?
No.
Okay.
and what I'm saying by that is that we had this conversation before, and I can't remember when you and I talked about this, but we have a really bad habit of looking at the market on a year-to-date basis, right? Market's up this year. Woo, I'm doing great. Market was down last year. I suck. The Fed doesn't look at things that way. They look at things on a longer term basis. And so if you look at where the market was 3 years ago, the wealth effect is still there. Yes, the market came down last year from a very overvalued level. In fact, the Fed mentioned last year that valuations were too high. And so they were even aware of that. So they brought, you know, that valuation did come down, but it's not come down. I mean, if you look on a 3-year basis, you're still positive. That wealth effect is still there. there's no panic on the Fed's part right now to start to try to boost the wealth effect because it's still there in the economy. Yeah, it's not as much there, but it has come down. But look, it hasn't been terrible. It's down 20%. You're up, you were up almost 30% in the previous 2 years. So, you got to put these things into a little bit of perspective and a little bit a bigger time frame when you're talking about the Fed, because they're not looking at month-to-month returns or year-to-date returns. They're looking at longer-term pictures.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. And again, yeah. I just think my point is, and I'm actually curious to know if you agree with this, is I think the Fed would love for the market to continue to go down, I don't know, another 20, 30%, just so it doesn't have this Frankensteinian, crazy asset bubble in a market that just, I mean, all year, the Fed's been super frustrated with the market. Guys, I'm trying to get you to be less sanguine. And the market's like, we don't care. Party, party, party.
Yeah, no, I think I'm going to, let me share a couple of charts with you. I think I stumbled across this today. I was actually doing a tweet this morning, and I stumbled across a graph that really kind of set me back for a minute. Then, of course, I went down the rabbit hole of really starting to look at this in a lot more detail. So here, let me just share this graph here real quick. So can you see my screen?
I can. Yep. This is actually a chart I was going to ask you about in a bit, but let's go for it now. Okay. Oh, wait, no, not this one.
Let me back up here just a little bit. I'll get to that one. So this is the annual change. And so this goes to our point that we were just talking about. So here's one of the reasons that the Fed may want to lower interest rates to get consumer confidence back into the market, right? And that's because the annual rate of change in the supply of money, right? So M2, we did this massive $5 trillion worth of stimulus. That's that pig in the python we talked about. It's now coming out. So we've had this massive drop in M2. So there's certainly a relationship in the economy between money supply and inflation, right? So, Keynes says, inflation is always and everywhere, inflation always is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. So we had this massive surge, no surprise with, shut down economy, lots of money to spend. We had inflation, right? Supply and demand, basic economics. So if the Fed needs to have more confidence, if that money supply is going away, you're going to start losing more and more consumer confidence. That's certainly going to be the case. Retail sales are slowing down. That's going to feed through eventually. The more that people can afford to make ends meet, that's going to certainly weaken confidence. So if I can boost asset prices by cutting rates or whatever, getting the market to go back up, well, that's going to help alleviate some of that risk. That's a stretch to make because there's some other stuff that's going on in the economy. Breaking inflation rates. This is the graph that I stumbled on this morning, and I started running a rabbit hole on this and found some pretty. Hey,
sorry, can you move your cursor? I want people to be able to see what each of those lines is described as.
Okay, so the red line is CPI inflation.
Okay.
Right? And so the black line is the 10-year break-even inflation rate. And so what you notice is the break-even inflation rate is coming down. CPI is more elevated above the 10-year break-even inflation than this data goes back to. And that's because that 10 years out, inflation expectations were never that inflation was here going to be permanently, right? So we had all these people coming out, inflation's here, it's going to be permanent. It's going to be the Weimar Republic, et cetera, so forth and so on. The break-even inflation rates, the market never bought into that story. And the market has been well ahead of CPI inflation coming down. Now, here's where this gets really interesting. So think about break-even inflation for a moment, which is the different. All break-even inflation is the difference between nominal yields and real yields. That's it. So what is it? What's the differential? And that's inflation rates. And this says a lot about economic activity. So think about economic activity and all the things that are related to economic activity. And if inflation is coming down, that means you have demand destruction, right? People are buying less, so you're getting slower economic growth. And that has a lot of impact on a variety of other things. So here's break-even inflation rates versus GDP. you'll notice that break-even inflation rates tracks GDP over time. Obviously, as inflation rates are coming down, so is economic growth. That makes complete sense, right? That's just basic economics, that if inflation is coming down, you got less demand, that means you have less economic growth. But here's where it starts getting interesting. This is 10-year break-even inflation rates versus net profit margins. Net profit margins surged in 2020, 2021 because of all that money coming into the system, no demand. So I was able to charge prices well above what the cost was to make them. So I had this massive surge in profit margins. That's clearly unsustainable. But if break-even inflation is going to continue to fall, which it will, as this lag effect of rate hikes come through the system, then net corporate profit margins have to fall a lot further. And so again, this is going to make, it doesn't mean the market's going to crash, but it certainly says that returns out of the market are going to be very difficult over the next few years. In other words, the years of generating 12% annualized rates of return are likely behind us for a while. Here's breaking inflation rates versus reported earnings. Again, you see that big surge in earnings over 2021, 2022. That's not sustainable because we don't have that $5 trillion worth of money in the system anymore. As demand falters and break-even inflation rates fall, earnings are going to have to fall even more. So they've come down some, but they haven't come down enough yet to justify what the economy and what inflationists tell us the economy is going to be doing in the next 12 months. That earnings to economic activity is clearly not aligned itself yet. Here's where it gets really interesting. This is the one that I put out on Twitter this morning. This is break-even rates versus oil prices and energy stocks. The correlation was so sharp that it took me back for a minute. I had to go back and look at this a couple of times. But this also is just simply a function of economic activity. And if inflation is falling, the demand for economic activity, goods and services are going to fall, a la oil prices will eventually fall, and energy stocks, which have a high correlation to oil prices, will also deteriorate as well. So, I thought there was just a lot of really interesting correlations that all spin off this idea of weakening inflation. And that's what we all want. We all want lower inflation, but we also have to understand there's a consequence
right, for
this inflation. And that's not necessarily bullish. One last chart for you, and I'll let you go because I know I'm hitting you up with too many charts today. This is net corporate profit margins versus PPI, CPI. One thing that we started tracking a while back was the spread between the producer price index and the consumer price index. The theory is that if I'm a producer and Adam is the consumer, if I can't pass on my higher input costs, so energy prices go up and I make a good or a service that has petroleum in it, right? So my input costs go up because of higher commodity prices. And if I can't pass that on to Adam as a consumer, I've got to eat it in my profit margins, right? That's just going to reduce my profit margins. So when that spread of PPI to CPI goes negative, that's when you have your biggest decline in profit margins. And we just went negative this month by a fairly large margin.
Yeah, look at that.
Yeah, so this is something that I think is all, and also this is oil prices and the CPI, PPI spread, same thing, right? This is just supply and demand.
Yeah, and they tend to be correlated with recessions, not always, but it looks like, we've always had a recession when it's gone negative. We just haven't, going negative doesn't necessarily guarantee we're gonna have a recession.
Yeah, that's correct. So anyway, it's just something I'm working on. I'm writing an article about this right now because I just thought it was very interesting. This is just one of those things that, when you start, but it makes sense when you start thinking about the impact. And everybody's, inflation comes down, the Fed's going to cut rates, and it's all going to be bullish for stocks. That's kind of a hard argument to make when you start thinking about the impact of lower inflation as a function of demand destruction.
Yeah. And as we've seen too, in past cycles, and I think you've got a chart on this that we'll talk about in a minute from the article that you wrote. Every time the Fed hikes, it breaks something, right? We've had many recessions where the Fed has been cutting rates all through the recession, right? So, again, people in their mind think Fed pivot, happy days are here again immediately. Oftentimes it's like, no, the happy days don't return for like a year or two after the Fed makes its first cut, right?
Yeah.
All right.
But that just goes back to what we said earlier. If the Fed's cutting rates, there's nothing good going on. generally.
Yeah, yeah. And I also want to make it clear too, because this is sort of what got us on this trap, is like, I don't see the Fed cutting rates. Like, again, unless something really bad happens, I think Powell's plan is, yeah, maybe I got one hike in me. I don't know, maybe another one, but I'm close probably at this point to stopping. But then I'm holding there. I got to wait for the lag effects. I got to see if I've done enough. I'm not going to take my, you know, boot off the neck of inflation until, you know, its heart has pumped its last, you know, beat. And I know a lot of people don't think he's going to be able to do that. But that's his plan, right? Yeah. So I think the surprise factor here is much more likely to be on the side of those that are expecting a pivot by July and not getting it.
Yeah, and look, you know, go back to 2012-ish, you know, we had a manufacturing recession, but we didn't have a recession. Mm-hmm. And that's because the services sector held up, and that's a larger component of the economy than the manufacturing. And so, you know, I said this earlier about, you know, one thing that could surprise a lot of us, including me, that, you know, while I still expect we'll have a recession, the problem is everybody expects we'll have a recession. We've talked about before when everybody expects something to happen, doesn't. But so while I expect probably a recession to happen, and certainly to your point, Adam, tons of data, right? Survey after survey after survey, leading economic indicators, our economic composite index, you name it, all say a recession's coming. But one of the challenges could be is that the way these hits are coming, right? So first it was residential real estate, and then it was banking, and then it was commercial real estate. And, you know, and they're kind of falling kind of one after another, which is allowing for the economy to hold up while these things go through their cycle bottom and then start to turn back up. So maybe, and I'm not saying this is the case, so don't go run off and said Lance said this is gospel, because I'm not, but I'm just saying is that one of the things we need to consider and be open to is that the services sector is strong enough because it's such a large portion of the economy that because of all that pent-up demand we had from 2020, 2021 of shutting people off and changing the way people's behavior is, right? You know, how often do you order food out or work from home now, or things that you were not doing prior to 2020 that you're doing now? And does that potentially help support the economy enough to have these rolling kind of fallouts happen without the economy actually tripping into a deep recession? Yeah. Just that's one possibility that I think we have to at least put on the table to consider, that the bottom doesn't fall out all at once and we're down 30-40% from here.
I agree with you. We have to put it on the table. I don't buy it. I think there's a whole host of reasons why I have a really hard time buying that. The markets don't care what I think. So I totally,
they don't care what I think either, by the way. So.
Well, I was going to say, there's this joker who wrote this piece called Recession Odds Jump as the Fed Crushes Consumers. I don't know what that guy was smoking.
But you can't pull that article without pulling Tuesday's article, which was bullishness is rising and that's good for the market. So, you know, you got to have the point counterpoint here, Adam, you know.
I feel like we kind of already talked about the bullish, you know, elements in the market. I do want to get to your recession piece here in just a minute. Real quickly, sure. Though, there's something that's worth talking about, because I think it's a really big deal. I actually think M2 shrinking is a really big deal. And we will talk about that more in the context of your article. But it's bank lending. It's bank lending standards tightening here. Yep. We think we talked about this last time. You know, Powell said, look, I'm not sure I'm going to hike going forward because the banks are now tightening lending standards even more following the bank failures that we've had here. And that substitutes as additional rate hikes. And I kind of asked that on Twitter, hey, does anybody have any quantification of this incremental tightening? Like how many more basis points of rate hikes do we think that that's adding into the system? I got some feedback, a couple articles were sent my way. Estimates all over the place, from an additional 50 basis points to a couple hundred basis points. You know, we don't know, but it's not nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, before Silicon Valley Bank failed, you and I were warning that, you know what, the Fed might be over tightening here, right? And maybe it should pause now and watch, right? Well, now we have, the Fed did hike again. It may, 80% chance it's going to hike again in May. And on top of that, we have this bank tightening that's going on. So the demand destruction is like getting ramped up even further here beyond what the Fed itself is doing here. I think that is a, I'm not going to call it a game changer, but that's like a, you know, it's like, I don't know, you're in the third quarter against a team you're losing against. And then all of a sudden they bring their biggest player on the field who's been sitting on the bench the whole time. And he's totally fresh going into the fourth quarter, right? It's just not a good sign.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think, you know, and, you know, you have to pay attention to today's retail sales numbers, you know, as well, because that was a very big decline, especially when you look at retail sales on an inflation adjusted basis. That was a huge decline in real retail sales. So, you know,
okay. And retail sales were down 1%, right? A full percent last month. Yeah.
You slap inflation on top of that. Even if you say inflation's running at 2% annualized, right? I mean, that's still, you know, a very big drop in inflation. And again, you know, so, you know, one thing too is that when we talk about inflation rates, we talk about, well, inflation on a year-over-year basis was 5%. And you and I talked about this, you know, in June saying, you know, when the year-over-year comparisons catch up, all of a sudden inflation is going to drop very sharply because of just the roll-off of inflation. And if you actually look at inflation over the last 3 to 6 months, inflation's running about 2%. We're right at 2.3%. You know, the reading yesterday was 0.1%. So annualize that by 12 and you're at 1.2%, right? So, you know, so inflation in a shorter term basis is really come down back to its kind of normal growth trend, which is what you would expect to occur anyway. The question now becomes, though, is it too little too late? And is what happening and what we're seeing now in retail sales a function of that lag effect starting to catch up finally with consumers? Inability, you know, I saw an article out the other day saying, well, credit card debt wasn't as up as much this month as everybody thought it would be. Well, that's not necessarily a good sign either. It may mean that people can't get any more credit.
Right. Debt saturation or just people are just saying, look, I got to start tightening my belt here. Yeah.
Well, and if consumer lending standards are tightening, the first thing they cut off is more credit card debt.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Especially the higher risk revolving credit. Yeah.
Right. So don't think it's frugality setting in. It may be a lack of ability.
And we've talked about that, right? The debt saturation has two points to it, right? One, the consumer says, look, I can't take on any more debt because if I do, I can't service the debts I have. Most people aren't that mathematical. They're just like, give me more, right? And the banks are like, sorry, buddy, you're cut off. That's the other element, right?
And that's normally the way it works. It's just
it is normally the way that it works. Real quickly, before I forget, just in case folks want to go watch it. So I interviewed economist Steve Hanke earlier this week, and he basically said two things. He said a recession's baked in the cake at this point. And he said, the inflation fight's over. He says it's all over except for the waiting at this point, which is kind of what you're suggesting might be the case here.
No, it is. And look, I don't think the Fed should hike rates anymore. I think they need to stop. They should have stopped before, but they're going to hike again. I think they're going to regret that one. The question is just how big is the fallout and when? And that's really what it comes down to. And again, you know, and how does the market take that? You know, the thing we have to remember about the markets is always that markets are pricing in what they expect to happen. And so the thing that we as individuals always kind of miss, we kind of get into these weeds of all this economic data, go, well, man, this economic data is horrible. That means the outcome is going to be terrible. Well, the question we always have to ask ourselves, well, how much has the market already priced this in? Because we've been talking about this for a year, right? I mean, we've had this conversation over and over and over again for the last year and a half. How much of this has already been priced into the equity markets already? And that is also going to temper some of that downside. So, you know, this is a very challenging environment. And you know, this is something Mike and I talk about on a regular basis, you know, every day when we have our investment meeting is it doesn't make any damn sense, but we got to increase equity exposure. And, you know, Monday, depending on how the markets, you know, kind of look over the weekend or kind of if any other shoes fall, we're going to have to probably increase some equity exposure next week. We'll see.
But that makes no sense, right?
So.
Yeah, and that's why I'm so glad I don't have your job, right? Because especially right now, there is, I mean, for a long time, there's been a disconnect between the data and the markets. But now we have so many data points that are in rollover, and we have just so many key ones, right? Like money supply, like credit. I mean, things that, you know, credit is... it's the circulatory system of the economy, right? Like when that contracts, you just, the economy can just do less, right? When the money supply contracts, Henke did this. He went through the equation of the quantity value of money. And he's like, look, when you have less money out there, prices have to come down. It's just mathematics, right? So these are like increasingly like big universal forces of nature to a certain extent that I don't like to be on the other side of the fight with, right? So it's like I said, I don't like having your job because, as I say, the market can be irrational longer than you can be solvent, right? Like there's just times where the market can just continue partying, even though the cops are there and they're like carting people out, right? So
yeah, I think the cops showed up and they started drinking. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, for a decade there, right? The 2009 through 2021, the cops showed up with alcohol, more alcohol, right?
Exactly.
They were
doing the bear runs.
Yeah. So you're trading the markets we have, not the markets we think we should have. Yeah. But it's going to be hard because I imagine you're like, look, you know, yes, I guess we got to do this, but we got to have a plan in place to like completely reverse strategy if the fundamentals really start playing out.
Well, and that's why I was kind of joking with you a little bit, but you know, that's a, you know, you pulled this article about, you know, recession that I wrote on Friday, but you have to pull the article on Tuesday as well. And so every week I'm writing, and this is the most challenging part, which is I'm having to write a bullish article and a bearish article every week, which is not normally the case. But I write this bullish article, and now I've got to come back and temper it with a more bearish article because we're just, you know, just trying to evaluate that risk. And again, if you sat in on our conversations between me and Mike and the investment team, it's a bunch of bears sitting around the table going, "Who wants to be bullish?" And nobody's raising their hand, right? You know. But at the same time, we realize that, you know, we have to manage that equity exposure for what the market. But look, the NASDAQ's up like 18% this year, right? I mean, who would have thought that was going to be the case? You know, last November, I wrote an article, FANG stock, you know, why FANG stock.
Are the FANG stocks dead? Yeah.
Right. And we were saying, no, they're probably not. And then this year, they're up 18, 19% this year already. You know, so that's a, you know, how much of a return in the market did you miss by being out of the market? Right. And that makes no sense. I mean, there's no reason the FANG stock should be up that much, but it's because of disinflation. Disinflation comes down. That's good for earnings for, you know, high growth companies, even though Apple and Microsoft really aren't high growth companies anymore. But those are big safe names in that disinflationary space. So they're getting the benefit of the money flows. And that's something that totally kind of defies logic, but that's how markets work.
Right. And that's also our giant mindless robot of the algorithms, right? Just every new dollar, X percent of it goes into them, whether it makes any sense or not.
Right. The passive indexing phenomenon. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, just crazy, crazy times we're in. Hey, first, before I forget, could we sometime get Michael on here and have you guys go through one of your committee meetings, like on video? It would just be so interesting for people to see.
You put it out there for the audience. If they want to do that, we'll do that.
All right, folks, if you're interested, let us know. But I think I know the answer. I think people are going to be like, we'd absolutely love to see that process. It'd be fascinating.
Okay, because it's basically just me and Mike throwing erasers at each other. So that's pretty
honestly, I'd still like to see that, especially if the ones he throws at you are hard and sharp. Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, it's all very
good. But we do live in this crazy world. Now, I want to get back to quickly just to a point we were making earlier, right? When I asked you, when's the last time that T-bills were returning a real rate, right? And it's so weird that feels so strange to you and I, because up until this modern era, right, that's the way it was. You saved your money and then you would retire and then you would live off of the fixed income of your safe investments, which would give you a real return to actually live off of, right? But we're now so used to this highly deformed world where we're like, that's crazy that, you know, treasuries should give you a real return. I mean, how bananas is that?
I know it is. And I'm paying attention to you, but I think I have a chart on this. I was just looking real quick to see if I could find it. But I think I pulled a chart recently because I was writing an article about this, about, you know, how the savings rates for individuals, you know, in other words, the Fed doesn't pay individuals for saving. And I think if I'm not mistaken, the last time that we had a positive net effect on savings was prior to 2007. And again, I'm just looking really quick. I can't quite put my hands on it. I'll look for it and send it over to you. But, you know, it's been a while, but it was prior to 2007 was the last time you actually got paid to have money in the bank.
Yeah, which is crazy because that's what? That's 16 years ago now?
Yeah, just round it up to 20. I mean, it's almost 2 decades ago. And again, most people can't, you know, first of all, the majority of investors in the market today didn't start until after 2008 anyway. So, you know, it's, you know, when you start talking about the turn of the century and those type of things, that makes you feel really old. You know, and
especially
if
you call it the turn of the millennium, then it's, makes you sound really old.
That really gets you. But yeah, I mean, it's been a long time since people were paid to actually. I mean, look, I remember back in 1999, I was trying to sell CDs at 8%. Nobody wanted them because I could make 20% in the market. You know, in 2001, everybody loved those 8% CDs because, you know, you weren't making 20% in the market.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, if you could buy a CD today at 8%, how many would buy it? Raise your hand. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and sorry, that's another question I was going to ask you when you were going through your Geeks on Parade chart there of all the, which was awesome. I mean, I was right there with you. And I think a lot of our audience was too. It's great to totally get a chance to geek out like that on the macro data. But, you know, most of those charts were saying, look, a lot of assets are going to have a harder time going ahead, right? There's likely going to be a downward repricing. So to your colleague, Mike Leibowitz's, you know, advice is like, look, we may have seen the peak in yields here. Like, this is a great time to lock in some of these rates. And it, you know, if you're expecting a lot of risk assets to have headwinds ahead of them, yeah, maybe it makes sense to put a good chunk of your portfolio in getting 4%+ for the next couple of years.
Yeah, no, if you gave me a choice right now and you said, Lance, absolutely gun to your head. You can only have one investment. You can either have the S&P index or 10-year treasury bond. Hands down, no question, easy answer, I would buy chocolate. The 10-year treasury bond. definitely buy the 10-year treasury bond. It's a no-lose game, right? Because if I buy the 10-year treasury and I'm completely wrong and inflation goes up and interest rates go up, I still get all my money back plus 3.5% or 4%, whatever I could lock in the treasury rate for whatever period, right? Depending on which treasury you bought.
Yeah.
But even at the 10-year treasury, and then if I'm right and inflation goes down and economic growth slows, the yield declines towards 1%, I'm gonna have a big capital appreciation of my bond, then I'll sell it and then go buy stocks because they'll be cheap with a high dividend yield, right? So it's really a no-lose situation to buy 10-year treasuries. But again, you know, for most people, they can't make that kind of financial commitment. And that's really what it is, because you've got to be committed to that trade, you know, for the long term. You got to be willing to hold that for 10 years. And a lot of people aren't willing to do that.
Yeah. Hey, you're reminding me that a couple videos ago, you shared your sort of whole life insurance solution for kind of being your own bank, right? And you're doing that to basically lend yourself the money for the mortgage for the house that you've just closed on. Tons of interest from people in doing that. And so we're going to need to actually make good on our promise to do a webinar at some point soon on that. You're nodding, right? So you're in on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a note here. I've got Michael Leibowitz is flying into Houston the week of the 24th or 25th, we've got client presentations all week for that. So probably the first week of May, maybe we can do that somewhere around there.
Okay, great. Yeah. So talk to your team, come back to me, and I'll just let everybody know once we have a time. But what maybe think of that is that's another thing where you kind of have to be committed to it. You know, there are some of these investments that can give you great returns, but you have to really be prepared to invest in them. You can't just jump in and jump out.
Correct. In a lot of these cases, you know, everybody always looks for the market to be some kind of get rich quick scheme. And I was actually talking about this on the radio earlier this week, you know, and there was an article out, a CNBC survey, and it was talking about how many parents, you know, Gen X and baby boomers are making financial sacrifices to help their children, right? And they're putting themselves into financial ruin by doing this. And
it was 68% of parents of Gen X and boomers saying that they were taking financial sacrifice to support their adult children, their children who are 18 or older. Yeah.
And my point was twofold. One is that that's really stupid to do that, because if you do that now, so you know, I'm going to bail out my kids. I'm going to put myself in a financial to pay for my kids' college or bail them out of repeated credit card mistakes, whatever it is. I know that as a parent, you
buy their first house for them, whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is. You know, as a parent, that's my responsibility. That's great. Okay, awesome. You've now done that. And guess what happens now? You are not financially prepared for retirement and you become a burden on your children, because that now they've got to take care of you. And this is why we have this big rising trend of multi-generational families living together, where I call it the sandwich generation, because the kids are sandwiched between taking care of their parents and their kids. And it financially ruins everybody. So, you know, you may think you're helping your kids out, but I'm going to help them and they'll be better off down the road. And then they've got to wind up taking care of you. So really, what did you do for them? You didn't do a lot. So don't do that. But the second thing is this also brought up the bigger point about this whole idea about how markets compound over time and just invest in the stock market and you'll be rich and you don't need to really save money because the market will do it for you. And it's a complete load of crap. I mean, we've had three major bull markets and you have 80% of people in the country that can't come up with $500 to meet an emergency. So that obviously didn't work the way that people thought it would. But this is why you treat the market like a casino. The market will treat you like a casino and it'll take all your money. If you treat the market as a way to inflation adjust your savings over time, it will treat you well. But that means a much lower rate of return than get rich quick. It also means that you've got to do your job of saving a lot of money. And because what the market will do is just make sure those savings compound for purchasing power parity. But the onus of becoming wealthy is on you, of saving money, growing your business, whatever it is that you do to build wealth. The market just keeps you wealthy. It doesn't make you wealthy. And that's a huge distinction when it comes to managing your money.
That is a great point. And I really, let's stand on this just for a second here, because I think most people are taught, I mean, not in school, because school doesn't teach anything, but they're sort of taught by society that the way to wealth is through investing. And I think what you're saying is the way to protect and grow your wealth prudently is through investing, but the way to wealth is actually through other means, right? Like you have a wealth creation and then sort of a wealth stewardship part, and the investing is more the wealth stewardship part. And therefore you as a wealth creator have to say, okay, investing is only a part of my responsibility, right? Like I've got to actually work on something that's going to generate income and hopefully generate an increasing amount of income over time and hopefully a diversified set of income streams over time, right? And then I will, you know, protect and multiply that, you know, through investing. But I'm not going to take a little bit of money and then magically transform it into a lot of money as an investor. I mean, unless you're lucky, right? But and what that does is it also changes your expectations and your approach to investing. In one big way is it makes you not stretch for risk that you shouldn't be taking on, which is you've said many times, Lance, is it's much more important over the scope of your lifetime to avoid drawdowns as it is to catch the upsides, right?
Yeah, it is. And then look, I mean, this is, you know, think about all the people that were, remember in 2020, 2021, you and I were talking about the speculative frenzy in the markets, you know, the IPOs and the SPACs and all that. And that was get rich quick money, right? How'd that turn out for a lot of people? A lot of people lost. You know, I got an email the other day from one of your listeners that emailed me and says, you know, hey, you know, I was investing in the markets. I've lost everything and I'm starting over now. You know, what do you advise? Right. It's like, well, don't do that again. And let's try something different. And it was very interesting. I got another email and I thought this is very reticent of this generation. If you want to learn to be a good investor, there is only one book you need to read. You know what it is, Adam?
The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham.
Securities Analysis, 1934 edition, but either one of those will do.
Okay. But
yeah, you read the Securities Analysis by Ben Graham. That is the Bible of investing. Now, it's about yay thick, right? So it is not an overnight read. So I recommended that one of your viewers emailed me and said, I'm interested in learning about stocks. I was like, great, read this book and then let me know if you have any questions. He says, well, it's too thick. You know, the problem is that to be a good investor, it takes work. And, you know, people make fun of me all the time. It's like, you know, you do too, by the way, just, you know, because yeah, I write all these articles about stuff. That's just me doing research. That's how
I do it for a whole variety of reasons. But yeah, anyways, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I know you make fun of me for a lot of reasons, but but no, the reason I write so much, the newsletter, the daily market commentary, you know, that's just us doing our internal research and we just publish it for you to have.
Right.
But that's how we, you know, kind of keep track of all this data and then encapsulate it into some form, right? It's great to have a chart, but what does the chart mean? And when you have to write out context around that chart, you've got to organize your thoughts and say, okay, this is the flow of data and what's happening. And this should be the logical output from what is happening, whether it's, you know, technical data or economic data or whatever it is. But it just requires, investing is not easy. It requires work. And as an investor, we have to approach it, you know, Adam, as you said, we have to approach investing in a manner with which the market can actually generate returns. And, you know, think about it real quick. Let's talk about some of the richest people in the world right now. Warren Buffett, Elon Musk, Ray Dalio. You could throw in a few more names for me, I'm sure. But what do all these people have in common? Jeff Bezos, Amazon, super rich people, right? They've created massive amounts of wealth. They did it with other people's money, right? Jeff Bezos started Amazon with a $250,000 loan from his parents. Nothing wrong with that. That's how businesses get started, right? You borrow money and then you build a business and you create wealth from that. But the wealth alone wasn't the function of what created the massive wealth for Amazon, right? He went public, he got investors to come into the business, and he managed all that investor money to build this business to grow it. Same thing for Warren Buffett, right? Warren Buffett has been a phenomenal investor, has made people wealthy beyond their wildest dreams, but he has basically built wealth off of other people's money being invested into his business. So
that's true. Sorry to interrupt, but one other important part about all these people too, including Buffett, is they are value creators, right? So like they're starting a business, right? They're not just pushing paper. And you can say, well, hey, wait, no, Warren Buffett just buys companies. But well, he buys companies that he can then go in with his management teams and influence its destiny, right? He's not just building a portfolio of stocks. He's actually creating companies that his operators make better companies. So there's this part of like agency that's really important in the story.
Well, you stole my end of my story, which is
simply, sorry.
No, but you're absolutely right. So Ray Dalio, right, ran the world's biggest hedge fund using other people's money. The point is that none of these people got wealthy just by investing in the stock market. They got wealthy, to your point, by building a business that created the wealth.
Right. Well, and using other people's money to start the business that they created.
That's capitalism, right?
Exactly.
That is the very basis of capitalism. You know, when I started my businesses, you know, I've started tons of businesses in my life and I've borrowed capital to do that. There's nothing wrong with it as long as you understand what you're doing and that you've got a risk reward, you know, kind of business plan in place that says I'll borrow this money and I'm going to make this much return on it and, you know, go from there. So, you know, but the point is that, you know, people go, well, you know, if you invest in the market, you're going to get rich. Maybe you might get lucky and hit the one stock that goes from, you know, you bought Amazon and then you stuck it in a drawer in 1995 and you didn't look at it. Now you're wealthy, right? That doesn't happen for most people. You know, I let all these articles you see, I saw one yesterday. $10,000 invested in Apple and, you know, 35 years ago would be worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. That doesn't happen, right? People don't do that. But what you can do to build wealth is do what other people do to build wealth, which is go out, take advantage of capitalism, start a business, grow your business, invest cautiously, protect your capital at all costs, because if you lose your capital, you're out of the game. That's the simplest philosophy, right?
All right. Yeah, I want to keep going on that, but I got a few other things that we got to close up here.
We'll spend a whole day on capitalism one day.
Okay, well, I think a lot of people would like that. I'm just going to squeeze in this little anecdote because it's very similar to what you said a few minutes ago. So I moved this weekend, as I told everybody. The guy who moved me was a guy who I used like 2 years ago to stain the deck at the place I was before. And 2 years ago, and I think I might have mentioned this to you, Lance, on this program, he was taking a break like every 30 minutes to go trade meme stocks on his phone. And I think we actually talked about this on this weekly market recap of like, I took that as a real sign of how, you know, the average person was getting swept up into this very dangerous game. And I talked to him at that point about like, you know, like this, are you buying any other type of stocks? Is this part of a portfolio strategy? Nope. I'm just killing it here. I know. And I kind of warned him and he said, thanks, buddy, but this is really working for me. So he shows up here for the move, and I deliberately didn't ask him about it, but he came up and said, oh, hey, buddy, yeah, I'm not trading anymore. After I lost more than 70%, I said, okay, I'm done with this, right? And the thing just, you know, as expected, right, just blew up in his face. And of course, he's just one of many, many people that suffered that fate. And this goes to, you know, all of our past discussions about, one, the conditions that created that ridiculous environment, but also the fact that, you know, our education system does not teach financial literacy. And so people are, you know, they turn to TikTok for advice. They see other people making money on these crazy, stupid bets, and they get swept up. And the people who can least afford the punishment are the ones that, you know, basically get crushed and decimated by this. So, you know, poor guy is going to be moving people from their homes for a long time now to make up for the losses that he took in this market. Right. Anyways.
There was a really good Wall Street article just recently talking about the same thing. Went through a whole bunch of people that had, like, this one guy had over $1.5 million invested in the markets, was killing it. He's now in Vegas waiting tables and driving an Uber, just trying to pay off his credit card debt that he had taken out to leverage into the market. So,
yeah.
You know, we'll finish here, this is the whole point, is that treat the markets with respect, treat the markets with, you know, dignity, and understand that the markets are not going to make you wealthy, but the markets can keep you wealthy. And if you do your work and do your job of saving and growing your money cautiously, you will be well rewarded. Not every minute of every day of every year. There's going to be some years where markets don't perform that well, but over time, you will make money and your savings will grow.
Right. And time being your big asset there, which is sort of, as you said many times, is like, don't screw up that advantage, right? Yeah. Like, don't put yourself in undue risk, like this guy who was trading the meme stocks, right? And be down some crazy amount in a single year that it's going to take you like a decade to get back to even, right?
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Look, I did say we were going to go through your article here. In the interest of time, I'm just going to mention one or two things from it.
I'll say we pretty much covered a lot of it, but go ahead.
We did. Well. Okay. So, folks, it's called Recession Odds Jump as the Fed Crushes Consumers. We are really beginning to see a lot of data here that's suggesting that the consumer is really beginning to get squeezed here for a whole variety of reasons. There's another article here. I just want to mention some of the things that it was talking about. It was talking about how spending is really beginning to slow down. We're seeing this mostly in the lower end of the spectrum, but the higher income households saw wages contract by 0.5% year over year in March, the first negative growth reading since May 2020, right? So it's now beginning to infect all parts of the socioeconomic strata. Tax refund sizes are materially smaller this year, so people have less to spend from that. Another headwind for lower income households is the expiration of increased benefits under the SNAP. That's the food support program. And so that expired at the end of February. So we're finally beginning to see the end of some of these pandemic crisis programs that just lasted forever, right? Beginning to end. Of course, those tend to hit the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum more. And then there's this last stat. Bank of America said that its card data shows that through March, lower income households, particularly those earning below $20,000 per year, which is not much, they may be turning to their personal and credit cards now for food purchases. So these revolving debt instruments are now being used for, you know, life essentials like food, right? And that has an expiration date on it, right? In other words, like, you can only do that until you've maxed out your credit card limit. The bank cuts you off. And then what do you do to eat, right?
That's I don't think that's starting now. I think that's been going on for a while, honestly.
Well, but I think it's getting to the point which we're talking about here, right? Where like that debt saturation factor is coming into play, right? Where they're literally not going to be able to continue. And now that they don't have the SNAP cards, it's going to accelerate the ending of this system because they're going to rely on the cards more. They're going to exhaust them faster, and then whatever the ending reckoning is going to be, we're going to find out relatively soon, probably. You talk about how the Fed is stuck between a rock and a hard place in your piece here. The rock is basically it's creating a recession by demand destruction, but as it destroys demand, consumers and the financial system increasingly start to stumble and are in danger and cracking under that, right? So I sort of liken this almost to chemotherapy, right? Where like you're injecting poison into the patient. You want to inject enough poison to kill the cancer, but not so much poison that you actually kill the patient, right? Right. And the problem is the Fed is not known as a precision player, right?
Right.
So it's very worrisome here, right? You know, their syringe that they're injecting the chemo with is more like a fire hose, right? they can't be all that careful with it.
Yeah, and so the rock, and to your point, the rock in the hard place is, you know, I have two choices of the Fed. Well, if I cut rates in order to help bail out the economy because I created a recession fighting inflation, I then create inflation that I was trying to fight before. And so now I've got to go back to hiking rates to fight the inflation. So it's a no-win scenario for the Fed. Right. And that's going to be the real interesting thing that comes out of this is the Fed's going to have to choose at some point. And the question is what do they choose and what do they sacrifice in the process?
Right. And we don't know, but it seems to our eye that the Fed has chosen whether to die by fire or ice. If fire is inflation and ice is, you know, cooling the economy, the Fed is choosing ice right now. And it's only going to go to fire if it's forced to by some sort of,
I think it's a little more complicated than that.
I'm sure it is.
Well, no, what I mean by that is that, you know, the Fed is choosing right now. They're going, okay, here, let me give you a good example of this. As Mike and I talked about this on Thursday on the radio show. Go back and look at all the Fed minutes. So you'll know this. So in 2007, Ben Bernanke said what about the economy? Do you remember what Ben Bernanke said about the economy?
In 2007, we don't need to worry. Everything's great.
Basically, he said, don't worry about subprime. Subprime is contained. It's a Goldilocks economy, even though he knew the economy was slowing down. This is the first time that I can ever, and Alan Greenspan, same way back in 1999, early 2000. Yeah, the economy is fine. It's a Goldilocks economy. Everything is okay.
Right. And then Yellen after Bernanke, we'll never have another crisis in our lifetimes. Yeah.
Jerome Powell came out and said, yeah, we could have a mild recession. Now, think about this for a moment, because this is critically important. You're the head of the Federal Reserve. What you say moves markets.
Right.
So,
it
moves the world. So if I'm the head of the Federal Reserve, that's why this language is always so manipulated and managed and tweaked. You know, what happens? You know, they always say, well, here's the FOMC minutes. That's complete hooky because what they actually say in the meeting is not what's in those minutes.
Right.
That's a very crafted message, because if the Fed came out and said, look, guys, you know, we really screwed up. We kept rates too low for too long. We're going to have a horrible recession. Well, immediately everybody goes, well, you know, stop spending everything. Fed says a recession's coming. And now you have a really bad recession. The point here is that the Fed is going, hey, I think we'll have a mild recession, which means it's probably going to be worse than a mild. But the Fed's choosing right now, they honestly think that, okay, I can navigate a mild recession because I have tools to support that. So if we have a mild recession, I'll cut rates and do QE, and we can boost the economy out of a mild recession. The problem is they never predicted a mild recession before. When they predicted a Goldilocks economy, it was a terrible recession. I'm just a little worried about how bad this recession could be if they're saying it'll be mild. Right. So,
yeah. Well, I'm right there with you. And the Fed, again, like I said, they're not a precision player. So, you know, they're probably jamming on the brakes too hard right now. Right. You have talked about the damage over tightening. I don't doubt that if and when they say, oh, we put on the brakes too hard, then we're going to take out the bazooka and stimulate again. I think they will. But it, you know, lurching violently from direction to is not a good way to navigate an economy. You create way too much collateral damage all along the way. But I think that that's kind of the operator we're stuck with.
Yeah, yeah. And we've been doing that since 2000. So welcome to the world, right?
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, look, so there were a couple of great quotes here. I don't think I need to go into them. They're probably just overkill to the points you're already making here. I just do want to reiterate that you do talk about M2. You have the chart in there. I guess I'll just sort of say, like, as so goes the money supply, kind of so goes the economy, right? I mean, I think that that's, Lacey Hunt is really clear on that. Like I said, Steve Henke was really clear on that. The chart that you showed, you know, show that money supply is contracting the most violently it has in the data series. I don't know if it's most violently ever in the history of the money supply, but it's probably got to be up there if it's not, right?
One thing too is there is about a 16-month lag between money supply and economic activity. So, you know, you have to go back to where that money supply spiked. We're now seeing that decline and just understand there's a lag effect in the economy. You know, you and I talked about the amount of money supply relative to GDP is still very elevated. So again, one of the things that may frustrate people, like, you know, is like, I don't understand why there's not a recession yet. You know, I'm set up for a recession and we're not having one. It doesn't mean it's not coming. It just may be delayed longer than you think because of all that money still working its way through the system. As you said, right? You know, all these, SNAP benefits and unemployment benefits, et cetera, still snaking their way through the economy.
Right, right. And I do think, you know, and your partner, Michael Leibowitz, is one of the guys out there who might actually beat me in flogging the lag effect more frequently than even I do. I think the lag effect is probably the most important and the least understood economic factor right now in terms of what's going to shape our destiny over the next year.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Last thing on this topic before we wrap up. I interviewed Michael Every from Rabobank earlier this week, and he had a really interesting he's a really interesting view in general, a smart guy, but also, he's situated outside of the US, right? So he's got a great scope of history in general, but he really understands much more so than we average Westerners do, kind of how the non-Western powers think. He's located in Asia. He covers Asian countries and companies. He's lived in Russia. He kind of knows how those guys think. In the type of world in which we're going into, he thinks that central policy is going to become a lot more targeted. So in other words, he said this has happened plenty of times before in history where, you know, right now we have a Fed that has two main levers, right? I'm going to raise rates or I'm going to lower rates, right? Or I'm going to stimulate or I'm going to tighten, right? And basically everybody feels the same effect, right? If the Fed's tightening, everybody feels that. He's saying going forward, it's probably going to be a lot more differentiated than that, where the Fed will say, okay, for this part of the economy, we're tightening. But for this part of the economy, we're going to stimulate. And it's this much more sort of command and control style where, you're trying to achieve one big policy objective with one, but another policy objective with another. Don't know exactly, you know, if that's going to play out or not, but it was sort of a way of thinking that was fresh to me. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. You know, for two decades now, the Fed has used one blunt hammer to just kind of pound the market into what they want to do. So this idea of using a scalpel, I'm not sure how you do that. I mean, you know, just very quickly thinking through it, right? I could put stimulus in place for the mortgage market potentially to stimulate housing demand, but not lower interest rates, right? You know, across the board. I'm not sure how they would actually.
Think about just what happened with the banking system, right? Yeah. Hey, we're still tightening, but banks, we're going to give you these lending facilities so that you get to skate along, right?
Yeah. And maybe that's, and he's right. Maybe that is actually how it'd be very interesting to see how that would work. And again, you know, the Fed has never demonstrated any type of real ability to differentiate between markets and use a scalpel, but right. Hey, first time for everything.
And he's not necessarily saying they're going to be great at it, He's just saying it's been done before, you know, expect that it could be done again.
Sure.
All right. So I'm going to skip over housing market. There is much to talk about there, but basically trends are still the same. We'll skip off layoffs, except just to note that they are continuing. I had another long list of companies and a whole bunch of other industries besides tech that are laying off people here. Yep.
Just one thing about housing. Just one thing about claims. Do pay attention to continuing claims. So when you file an initial claim, that's when you first get laid off. You file your first claim. That's your initial claim, right? So that's the number we get every week. There's a number that's also released every week called continuing claims. These are the number of people that continue to get claims after that first week. That number has been rising fairly markedly and is now up to a level that has normally preceded recessionary offsets. So that's the number, more so than initial claims, pay attention to continuing claims.
Yeah, because those are the people out of work, basically, that are saying, hey, right, I still haven't found work again, right? Yeah, right. Great point. That is a precursor to the, it's almost like the pre-diabetes indicator of the employment full-blown diabetes that you and I are expecting, you know, if this recession indeed arrives the way we think it will. All right, so what trades have you guys made this week, if any?
The only thing we did this week was we had bought ETF. So we had talked about in early February that the market was due for a bit of correction, which we got in March. So February, March, the market sold off. We got buy signals in kind of mid-March, and we added some ETFs. We bought some triple Qs, the NASDAQ. We also bought some S&P 500 and some equal weight S&P 500, just kind of some broad-based exposure for a trading purpose. We're still long our S&P and our equal weight. We did sell our NASDAQ position only because it actually triggered a sell signal this week, and it hasn't really taken. And when you get these sell signals, you know, everybody expects immediately that, oh, it's immediately going to sell off. And that's not the way things work. When things get really overbought, there's a lot of momentum behind them, so they can kind of keep going up for a little bit. But generally, more often than not, those sell signals will kick in. So we sold the triple Qs. You know, we're seeing this in a lot of areas. Gold miners extremely overbought. Gold's extremely overbought. Equities on the technology front extremely overbought. There's areas that there's pockets of the market that are not overbought, but they've also been out of favor and have no momentum. So there's going to be this rotation in the market. I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's the market is setting itself up for a rotational trade. It could be next month. But we're going to see a rotation out of these very overbought areas into these very oversold areas. That's just the way markets work.
Got it. Yeah. I was sort of laughing as you were saying that because I was up late last night, just catching up because of this move. And I was looking at the performance of the miners in my portfolio and was thinking, you know, this does feel kind of overstretched. I went and looked at a hedge that I was thinking about putting on. And to your point, was thinking, okay, well, you know, it's not like this thing is necessarily going to tank tomorrow. And then, of course, I wake up to have to do a recording, come and check the market. Precious metals down over 2%. Market miners getting clobbered. Like, so sometimes it does move real quick.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's just that, and again, this is the thing we always have to remember as investors. And I'd said something about this in a tweet or something. I can't remember. And a guy emailed me, was like, well, it's still going up. It's like, yeah, that happens sometimes. These things are not perfect timing indicators, but what they are is they just kind of tell you when risk outweighs your reward. So right. That doesn't mean, and what people tend to say is like, say, well, Lance said it's overbought, so I sold everything. No. That's not what you do. It means that if I own we look at term, we manage a portfolio, everything is involved in percentages, right? So if I have a portfolio position, I'm just going to use a real easy number. It's 1% of the portfolio, right? So I have a $100,000 portfolio and I buy 1% of Apple. Pick a stock. It doesn't matter what it is. I buy 1% of Newmont Mining. Okay. If Newmont Mining grows to be 1.5% of my portfolio and it's grossly overbought now, sell 0.5%, take it back to the original weight. And if the thing corrects, it now becomes 0.5% of your portfolio. You now take it back up to 1%, you average in at a lower price, and then you take the next advantage of the rally when it comes, because everything in your portfolio is going to ebb and flow over time because of how market dynamics work. So learn to take profits, and taking profits does not mean sell everything. It just means take a little money off the table. Again, you go back to the harvesting and the planting and the
exactly. Gardening. Your gardening analogy,
before, yeah. Right? Is, you know, if you don't take the tomatoes off the vine, That's great. You have beautiful tomatoes and then they rot on the vine. What good did it do you? Right. So you harvest the tomatoes and then the plant can grow more tomatoes.
Right. All right. Well, really well said. All right. Well, look, we will wrap things up here then, folks. Very quickly, just want to reiterate the core message of this channel, which is all about prudent wealth building. To do that, for most people, your odds are greatly improved by working with a professional financial advisor who takes into account all of the macro issues that Lance and I have been talking about in this video. If you have a good one who's doing that for you, creating a personalized plan for you, and then working with you to execute it on your behalf, great, stick with him. But if you don't, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, perhaps even Lance and his team there at RIA, and schedule a free consultation with the endorsed financial advisors that Wealthion offers, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the very short form there. Like I said, these consultations are free. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a public service they offer to help as many people prudently position as possible before some of the developments that Lance and I have been talking about might occur. Folks, if you've enjoyed this weekly market recap, even one iota as much as Lance and I manage to do every week, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Lance, buddy, another great week. It's always great doing these with you. Any parting bits of advice for folks here?
Yeah, I just want to let people know that you're the only person that will actually talk to me. So that's why we have these conversations.
Now you're going to get a lot of like sympathy emails.
I have no friends. So.
All right, buddy. Well, look, everybody else, thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us this week. We'll see you next time. We'll be right back.